The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network on.
September is Sepsis Awareness Month. Today is World Sepsis Day. There's almost 15,000 cases in Ireland of sepsis every year, and it results in staggering 3,000 deaths. A staggering 60% of all hospital deaths in Ireland are related to sepsis. I'm joined in studio now by Professor Ignacio Martin Lochez, who is a consultant in intensive care medicine and professor of intensive care medicine in St. James Hospital in Dublin, and Aisling O'Rourke, formerly a colleague of ours here in News Talk, whose dad passed away from sepsis in November 2020. Aisling, I'm going to begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
I remember your dad dying, and I remember seeing you post about it on social media and elsewhere, and offering condolences. But you might talk us through what happened to him.
My mother and I had been caring for my dad. We were sharing caring responsibilities while working. Since 2018, he had a condition known as AL amyloidosis. So he had undergone chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and was severely compromised in terms of his immune system. So 2020, obviously, we all know what happened that year. So we were being extra careful at home to make sure that COVID didn't enter the house. Then on November 13th, that Friday morning, now he was, because of the condition he had, he was technically in remission, but he was quite frail. He would have been 67 at the time. And that morning he went in, as would have been usual at the time, for his B12 injection with his GP. He hadn't been feeling that well and mentioned it and was told to go home and rest. But as the day went on, his condition deteriorated and he just really became unwell. And by the time I arrived home in around 4:30, my mum at that stage had already phoned his medical team, and the advice was get him to A&E. Okay. Now, Jonathan, caring for a family member who has a long-term illness, trips in and out to A&E are normal practice. You know, you get very used to it. So there wasn't any kind of a panic at that stage. I drove him down. My mum drove down behind me because we knew that it was unlikely that the both of us would be allowed into the hospital with him because of COVID. And I distinctly remember the conversation with him as we drove through Tullamore Town. The Christmas light ceremony was going to be the following weekend, and he was looking forward to coming down to see it. And I remember him saying to me that, you know, Ava, my goddaughter, God, she'll have great crack now when Santa arrives. And that's what he was looking forward to. He went in. I had to get assistance at the hospital. He had been, while he was frail, he was fully mobile. But when we got him down to the hospital, he wasn't able to get out of the car. So I had to get the assistance of two porters and a wheelchair. And we assisted him and brought him into the hospital. And then my mother and himself, they went in and were in A&E then for around 4 hours, where he underwent a number of tests and was eventually sent home with what we were told at the time was a minor infection.
Okay, so there was an infection identified, mm-hmm. but you didn't know what it was. The word minor probably put you at ease. But when did you start to realise that it wasn't mine?
He, at that stage, had cheered up, watched the rugby when he came home that night, caught up on the match that he'd missed, went to bed at midnight. We genuinely thought all was well. And then at 7:30 the following morning, the house phone rang, which nowadays would be highly unusual. And it was a doctor in A&E to say that he had to come straight back in, that the lab had found an infection in his blood. And that was at 7:30 that morning. So my mum answered the phone. She woke me up. We went down to my dad's room, realised that we were able to wake him, but he wasn't really compos mentis, if you know what I mean. So we weren't going to be able to get him out of the bed on our own without assistance. He was a 6'4" man and he physically couldn't lift himself out of the bed, and even between the two of us, we couldn't do it. So we had to phone paramedics and ask for assistance. We ended up having three paramedics come to the house that morning. We had a paramedic car and an ambulance, and I can't praise them highly enough. They treated us and my father with such dignity and really went to the rounds of the world. And there was quite a difficulty in getting a very tall man out of bed and through a traditional bungalow on a trolley, but they did it with dignity and they got him out of the ambulance. And they said that this to us looks like sepsis. And at that stage, they started sepsis protocol.
Okay, but it you had lost valuable hours though in coming home when he was fine.
Yeah.
To getting that phone call, waking him up, and realizing no, there's something wrong here.
My biggest regret, we had in the years of caring for Dad and even my own grandmother, both my mother and I and relatives, we would have sat up all night making sure that, you know, the person was okay and just checking in. And we had done that over the years with Dad between the two of us. Had it been suggested, that would have been how we would have responded. And unfortunately, we did. We lost those hours. There's no two ways around it. We did.
And when your dad got into the hospital then and the sepsis protocol was activated, when did you realise that, unfortunately, this was not the outcome that you were hoping for?
I think, Jonathan, I knew straight away when the paramedic said to me in the bedroom, "This to me looks like sepsis." I knew I had a gut reaction that it was bad. I didn't know what sepsis was. I didn't have an understanding of it. But I knew in his, given how frail he was there in front of me, I knew it wasn't going to be good. So when we went out the front door and the paramedic was closing the door on the ambulance, I just said to one of the gentlemen, I just said, "Look, I know it's COVID, but please, if the nurse who's minding Dad doesn't think he's going to make it, could she please call us and let us go down to say goodbye?" I knew myself it was very serious. So we sat and we waited, and that's all we could do, like many families around the country at that stage. And we were very lucky in that he didn't have COVID. And they, when he went in, that's the first thing they did. They tested him for COVID straight away and he was COVID negative. And we got a phone call to say that he had brightened up, that he was chatting and cracking jokes with the doctor, which in our family is kind of, we crack jokes to cope. You know, we try to be as bubbly as possible. Sometimes it hides our true feelings underneath, but the doctor thought he was doing well. And she said to us at that stage, "Look, if you don't hear from us in the next 24 hours, that's good. That's a good thing. You don't want to hear from us." Unfortunately, the phone rang very quickly a couple of hours later to come straight down.
And did you get to go in to your dad before he passed?
We did. And it was a very distressing scene. We could see, not because it was a hospital environment, because at that stage we were very used to hospital environments, but he himself looked distressed. And he wasn't able to speak, but we could see that he could understand what was going on. And he was looking to hold our hands and to grab onto us, and he looked frightened. And it was just an awful position for any of us to have been in. It was a very distressing scene and very distressing for him. And I was in the room when my maternal grandmother passed away in her own bed at home. And I remember how dignified and peaceful it was. And this was not that. And I honestly, Jonathan, I don't know how long we had in the room with him. It probably was about 15 or 20 minutes, maybe. It felt like seconds. But before we knew it, they said that they could try and ventilate him, but that it was unlikely that he would survive the procedure and it would only add to his pain and discomfort. So we knew that's not what he would have wanted. So that was a relatively easy decision for us. We said, no, if this is the time, let him go with dignity. And he was gone in a matter of minutes. So he had come home from A&D the night before at 10 p.m. The hospital phoned at 7:30 a.m. The paramedics left the house at 10 a.m. And Dad died at the age of 67 at 2 p.m. on the Saturday afternoon.
Mm, that's such a short time frame for anybody. And just the distress is clear. Aisling, I'll let you take a break because I want to speak to Ignacio. Ignacio, I know from speaking to doctors that sepsis is one of the things they fear the most. That if they don't spot it, if they miss it, the outcomes can be so severe that nobody ever wants to find themselves in that situation. But we are still in an environment where sepsis can unfortunately be missed. How can we prevent families like Aisling's going through that trauma?
Well, I think that, you know, the problem of sepsis is that it's a mix of things in terms of how an infection can trigger sepsis. So it's a medical condition, it's a life-threatening condition that is going to affect organ function. So we know that we are going to have signs and symptoms that they are going to put us on the spotlight of things are not doing well. And I think that the most important is what you highlight. Time is life. And having the time for us to intervene with mainly two things, that is recognition and treatment. And this treatment is going to be at the same time started with antibiotics and what we call supportive treatment, supportive measures. So that is fluids, oxygen, things that we can only have in a hospital. So recognition of sepsis is the most important thing. And unfortunately, until the World Sepsis Day happened, we had very little awareness of sepsis. And thanks to you for giving doctors the opportunity to highlight what sepsis is and having had the opportunity to express, you know, the gratitude to have the time to say this.
What are the things that people should look out for? Because this is an infection in the blood that is identified, that highlights a bigger issue. So what do people need to be on the lookout for, first of all, as members of the public, but then those in the medical community as well?
Well, I think that the HSC sent a campaign about sepsis that is going to follow the acronym of the letters in the sepsis. So sepsis is S for slur, speech or confusion. So that means that your brain is not going to work in a normal way. E for strange shivering, muscle pain and fever. P is for pacing, no urine. So that means that the patient is, when you are not going to the to make urine for a day, that thing is going to be worrisome. S is for severe breathlessness. I is for it feels like you are going to die. And S is for skin mottle or discolor. So as a summary, I could say that sepsis is triggered by an infection. Not all the infections are developing a sepsis. I would like to not to alarm the population, but we need to see that when sepsis is developing that we call organ failure means that some organs are not going to work well, and these are mainly three organs. So the brain, because you are going to be dizzy, confused, you are not going to express things clearly. The lungs, you are going to be short of breath, you are not going to breathe well. So that means that maybe just the effort to go from one room to another is a big, big effort, and you are going to be really, really short of breath. And the cardiovascular system, that is not an organ, but is a system. So that means that you are going to be tachycardic, you are going to have a very low blood pressure. I think that instead of having high blood pressure, is low. And you are going to be shivering, sweating, we call a cold sweat. I would like to also say that not all the sepsis are because you have a blood infection. So you might have sepsis because it happened in different... The most common reason for sepsis, source of sepsis, is respiratory. So, and we have seen with COVID, not all the COVIDs were septic, but we had patients that they can have COVID and they can develop a sepsis episode. Okay.
And so, again, it's something that you just have to be really, really conscious of. Aisling, if I can come back to you, how are you and your mum coping now? Because, again, that was a traumatic end to your dad's life, that it wasn't the route that anyone would have chosen. And you look at, even when we're talking about grieving for the Queen across the water, about, you know, the life that she led and the death that she had was one that probably would have been deemed fitting for such a long life. Your dad didn't have that opportunity. How are you both now?
We're both doing really well. We were lucky in 2020 in that my dad was an inspector with the Department of Agriculture, and he was, well, basically married to Tullamore Golf Club. So the two loves of his life gave him a beautiful guard of honour on the way to the cemetery. And I will always be grateful for the turnout on the day, despite the circumstances we all found ourselves in. It was amazing to see so many people turn out to pay their respects. Okay. We're both doing really well. My mum retired this year, so she is now a lady of luxury and adjusting to that. And I think the key thing for us throughout all of this has been that when my dad got sick initially in 2018, I happened to be at home with him and he had a stroke in front of me. And because I had grown up seeing the fast ads on TV, I instinctively knew, oh God, his face is drooping, his speech is slurring. Oh my God, he's having a stroke. I call 999. And I knew that without even thinking about it, because I think an awful lot of us have grown up watching that communications campaign
on TV. And
if
we just had the same kind of campaign around sepsis, we'd be an awful lot better. Aisling, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for giving us your time this morning. Regards to your mam. And also thanks to Professor Ignacio Martin Lushes, consultant in intensive care medicine.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.